Thursday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Game one of the finals in the books. We have a full breakdown of that, which Danny and I just got back from. And also want to talk about another intriguing team in free agency that can have max cap space, has a lot of young talent, the Milwaukee Bucks. We'll do a full cap breakdown of them, take a look at what free agents they might try to pursue and how that could affect their future going forward under new GM-in-waiting Justin Zanuck. So, Danny, has what happened tonight changed your feeling about the series in any particular way?
It has. Not dramatically so. I mean, it was just an exaggeration of something that I already felt. But Cleveland needs to do such a better job defensively than they did. And, of course, there are other things we can talk about. But it's as basic as that. If they defend even close to as poorly as they did in this game, they will have trouble winning any games.
Yeah, this was a super slow game. Basically, I stopped counting after the third quarter, but it was only 66 possessions through the third quarter, so they probably ended up right around 90, and they gave up 104 points, and that was with Steph and Clay doing absolutely nothing in the game. They were 2 for 11 on uncontested shots. They got their looks. Steph was just playing very oddly. He was not hurt. He just played a bad game. I think he created separation when he wasn't in isolation on occasion, just, was playing weirdly. But, Cleveland still gave up a ton of open looks. They failed to execute over and over again defensively. I think their strategy was to switch a lot of stuff. Their communication was terrible at it. They don't have the athletes to really do that much anyway. They couldn't just, know which guys to go over the pick and roll and which guys to go under on. I thought that was bad. And then, even more disappointingly for them, the Warriors took them completely out of what they wanted to do on defense.
You mean on offense?
Yes, the Warriors on defense, yes. The Cavs on offense.
Yeah, and that was the second storyline. It was funny when we talked about it, when the game was over, you chose the Warriors defense, I chose the Cavs defense. But they are two sides of the same coin in the sense of what was disappointing about this game. And the Warriors forced the Cavs into a lot of isolation, stagnant things. And those don't have to be the same thing. You can have off-ball movement in isolation. The Cavs didn't in this game, and that's something they can improve. But the Cavs were horrendous in those situations.
Well, I don't know if they can improve because, are you going to be like, oh, we're now it's going to be in our DNA to do this? I mean, you remember last year, even during the regular season, I thought that the Cavs had a ton of talent, but they weren't really doing anything too sexy offensively. Then, of course, once it became just the LeBron show in the playoffs due to injuries, you felt like, they just couldn't score on the Warriors at all because they didn't move the ball enough. That was a big problem. And then tonight, the Warriors, I think, really amped up the switching even more than they did in the finals last year just to avoid giving up three-pointers. Only during the competitive portion of the game, throughout the last 2 minutes, only 23-point attempts for Cleveland. That is not going to be enough for them to beat this team. And it's not like they were scoring a ton at the rim either. There was help at the rim every time, great contests, and the Cavs were only 18 out of 38 at the rim during the competitive portion of the game. So it's really, while they were able to play awesomely against some teams that just don't have any kind of answer and don't have the level of help defense that the Warriors have, just straight ISOing against this team, even when you get the switch with a weaker defender, I don't know if that's really going to be good enough for them to score. I mean, they might shoot better. They'll probably shoot better at the rim in some games, for sure. They might get Green in foul trouble. But, he and Iguodala, I thought, were the keys to the game. The Cavs just could not score on either of those guys.
Yeah, that was big. And also, just that the Cavs weren't creating the separation. Even when they created separation, it wasn't producing baskets in the same way that it was in the other series. You could think about even the Hawks, who have had a very good statistical defense this season. I think they ended up second in the league. The Cavs were creating these seams and then exploiting it and getting really clean looks. And, of course, that was also true against the Raptors. And in this game, that wasn't true. And I think part of it, we actually talked about this yesterday with Ben Simmons, but LeBron is an incredible fast passer. His balls move really quickly. They get there. Some of the best creation that the Cavs had were off of beautiful passes by him. I'm thinking of an absolute bullet he threw to Love. I think it was in the fourth quarter that Love ended up getting an and one on, because you have to adjust to that and you have to deal with that. But the other guys in that team don't do that in the same way, just because there aren't many human beings who are capable of what LeBron does.
Yeah, Kyrie really struggled on his isolations. I thought Curry did a very, very nice job on him. Clay was in foul trouble, so they went with Curry on Kyrie for most of the game. Also, they forced LeBron baseline a lot, which was a problem early because he was blowing right by Harrison Barnes, and then on Andrew Bogut wasn't getting over there. But when you go baseline, your passing angles are limited. You basically, maybe you can get the ball to the opposite corner, but you know, you can kind of stay home on that and take it away. Or maybe you might be able to throw it up to the opposite wing, probably not going to be able to get it all the way out to the top. So I thought they did a good job containing him, limiting his passing angles, which was essential. But you know, even when they got the switch, you just weren't able to do anything. So these are some of the stats here for Cleveland that really throws their offensive night into stark relief. They isolated on 18 possessions. They scored one basket. They got fouled twice and turned it over or missed on the rest of their isolation attempts. Like, how awful is that?
So that, as a point per possession, that's like, what, like 0.33 about?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't look at whether they made the free throws on the plays.
Well, there were only three missed free throws in the entire game, so let's give them.
So we'll assume, yeah, I mean, they would have made, that's basically 6 points on 18 possessions probably. And then on post-ups, they actually scored on their first three post-ups. LeBron, and you know, the line between a post-up and an ISO, especially for Cleveland, is a little bit different when it's LeBron or Love. But they actually scored on their first three post-ups, two by LeBron, one by Love, although that was a really tough fadeaway. And then they were 2 out of 12 the rest of the way. So they had 33 possessions, and they scored on 8 of them. And 33 possessions, that's like, you know, over a third of their possessions. That's a very, very high rate of possessions finished by isolations and post-ups. Those, as we know, are the least efficient possessions. They might be able to get a little bit better job on those, get fouled a little more, make some more shots at the rim. But if you're using up a third of your possessions in isolations or post-ups, it is very, very difficult to be efficient no matter who you are, especially when Golden State is just so good at helping and not giving anything up. Because if you think about what the spacing is, right? Like if you clear out the entire side for LeBron, now you've got four guys who, you know, one guy is going to be around the rim. Maybe if Thompson is in the game, you can help off of him. And even if not, even if it is Love at center or Fry at center, you still have four guys spaced out around the arc on the weak side. And if you bring help over, you could probably guard those guys with three guys and then be able to rotate out once they're able to swing the ball. There just isn't quite enough spacing. That's why when you run high pick and roll and you've got shooters around, it works so much better because you have three guys at the arc, but now you have to bring three guys inside the arc and then close out. It's much more difficult than if you're just kind of posting up and everyone else has to be on the weak side.
And the Warriors doing such a good job of switching means that they, in other circumstances, they didn't even have to, have to generate those seams because the Warriors just switched it and took away the airspace.
Yeah, that's a great point. Even Steph was defending LeBron reasonably well, Sean Livingston, then they were just able to have enough help behind him. Iguodala, even when they didn't bring help, he was able to stop LeBron pretty well, either by stripping him, by just making him uncomfortable on his shots. Like LeBron wasn't able to just straight up back down on him. And then Irving, yeah, he'll do better on some of these ISOs, but he was 1 of 9 on plays in the half court when he brought the ball and didn't pass at all. That's per ESPN stats and info. And that's way too many shots to have zero passes on for one guy.
Yeah, but
especially when you're not shooting it well. And this is a half-court possession, too. This is not like, hey, we're on the fast break here.
Yeah, it's a big problem for them. And one way to just talk about this game for me, and I don't remember whether I said this on our show or on my own, but I felt for this entire year that you have to play almost a perfect game unless the Warriors are playing really badly to beat the Warriors. And this Cleveland team, while they are much more talented in terms of just basketball players than they were last year, it is incredibly hard to get this combination to play perfectly. And Kyrie is a good encapsulation of that because he's a supremely talented guy, but he blows defensive possessions all the time. He was horrendous in this game defensively. And offensively, there are moments where he can't get out of his own way. So asking him to...
Well, so can we explain? I mean, people might look at the stat sheet and say, hey, Steph was 4 out of 15. He only scored 11 points. How can you say Kyrie had a bad game? Can you explain why he was so bad?
Sure. So the Cavs were doing a lot of switching, and what the Warriors were doing a lot of the time was just taking advantage of whoever they switched Kyrie onto. And a lot of defense sometimes is about the degree of difficulty. So he was being taken either on a back cut or off the dribble by Harrison Barnes. Barnes had one of the best first halves of his Warriors career, and a lot of that was exploiting Kyrie Irving. Some of it was Kevin Love as well.
Yeah, that was true. He messed up a lot of switches also, didn't get back on defense after his missed layups, both he and LeBron. I mean, all those missed shots definitely led to some transition points. And actually, I mean, the Warriors only had 9 fast break points, which is surprising to me. But every time the Warriors actually did get out in transition, it was curtains, or should have been. You know,
they missed a lot of open easy shots. They missed were a couple wide open threes they missed in transition. And the Warriors were getting looks in the half court that kind of looked like they were transition looks, just where a guy would just be open under the rim for no real reason. And so they just, as if they could find him.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't say it's no real reason. It's that they're running out to the shooters, probably.
It's certain circumstances is that, but it just seemed like sometimes it was just maybe an ancillary player just got slipped behind. A lot of times that was Kyrie on a back cut. But the Cavs just have to be at a level, because you can't give the Warriors that many kind of system-y, easy buckets, because they will get other buckets as well. They are a very talented scoring team. And when Stephen Curry and Klay Thompson shoot 2 of 11 on uncontested shots, and the Cavaliers still lose going away in this game, it has to be scary for their fans.
Now, the Warriors did shoot 15 out of 26 on twos outside the restricted area. That is not sustainable, even though there was some pretty bad Cavaliers defense on some of those plays, specifically on Sean Livingston, kind of in semi-transition or half-court situations. But you know, they also went 9 out of 26 on threes, which is not a great percentage or a great number of attempts for this team. And Steph and Klay just were not really driving the offense much. The Warriors have so many other things that they could still get to offensively. Like, they didn't even really have to like break the glass at all in this game when it came to their offense. And I just really doubt that the Cavs have much more in the arsenal other than just, well, I hope our guys do better scoring one-on-one next time against these switches. I mean, and you know, the Warriors have been playing against teams that switch a ton now for months and months, and the Cavs haven't. And when they did, it was just, all right, we're going to throw it to Love, who, by the way, was terrible posting up today, I thought.
Good in a lot of other things, but bad at that.
Yeah, or we're going to throw it to LeBron, and he's going to post up, or we're just going to let Kyrie ISO. And these teams just that they've been playing just haven't had the individual defenders. They haven't had the connectiveness. They haven't had the help. I mean, and this is just a couple of examples of like what is so awesome for Golden State, right? So, for example, LeBron is ISO posting on the left side of the floor. Draymond Green points to Klay Thompson saying, hey, you take my man Kevin Love in the corner. This is when Love was at center. And then Draymond went over and helped, and Love was taken away in the corner, and LeBron didn't really have anywhere to go with the ball. There was another time where they got the switch. LeBron was on Livingston posting up. Draymond went over to double hard, and then instead of doubling, just got Livingston out of there, and then he was just on LeBron. LeBron didn't really have anywhere to go. Or it was just simply they're going to switch and throw it to Kevin Love in the post on Andre Iguodala, and Andre just stopped him. You know, I don't think that, like, Kevin Love, unless he's posting up on, like, someone really small or getting just a straight-up easy duck in, just having him pound dribble in the post against anyone sort of Iguodala or Barnes after a 3-4 pick-and-roll switch, not really going to be efficient offense for Cleveland. So just all the little things, the connectedness, getting over, two-point-nining, and hey, you know, the Warriors had plenty of practice on this in the finals last year. We thought that maybe with more shooting this year for Cleveland, it might be different, but there wasn't enough imagination for Cleveland that they were able to free up their shooters with those kind of plays.
And there certainly are things that Cleveland can do better. I mean, they were only 18 of 38 in the restricted area, so that should be higher, you know, just in
normal. And LeBron was 6 of 14 at the rim, which is a I can't remember the last time he shot that bad of a percentage at the rim. Maybe last year's finals would probably be it, actually. I'm sure he shot below 50% at the rim in some of those games because it's not like he was shooting a ton of jumpers. He was basically, you know, shooting most of those at the rim. He's taking like 40 attempts. So he must have shot poorly in those at some point. But yeah, again, LeBron's lack of a jumper was an issue. They're going under on pick and roll with him a lot. You know, if they were just able to not go under on pick and roll, especially when he was involved with the center, then, you know, you might really be able to get something against this Warriors defense, but they just have not been yet.
Yeah, and that'll change. I mean, I still think that the Cavs are going to win at least one, still definitely possibly two games in this series. And, you know, who knows, maybe they can do more than that. But they, what this showed me was that they're going to need to play really well to win. And if we're talking about who is going to win the finals, they're going to have to win at least one game at Oracle, probably, you know, more than one, because I think the Warriors are going to win at least one game in Cleveland, and that will require a big game, considering how the Warriors struggled sometimes offensively and still won comfortably.
We still have to get to the Warriors' bench performance, what Cleveland could potentially do to adjust. But first, a message from our friends at SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the only place I ever go to look for tickets to a game or concert since they became the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. And that's because they aggregate together all the ticket buying options in one place. So you don't have to worry, oh man, I didn't go to the ninth site after I already looked at eight because they might have some cheaper tickets. No, now it's all in front of you on one site. It's an app on your phone, so you don't have to bother with like CAPTCHA, fill out a bunch of squiggly lines. And every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find if there are underpriced seats. And if you're trying to sell tickets as well, those rankings, you can get an idea for what the market is. If you're just trying to sell your tickets and get a fair price, and that's really a great way to do it, to get an idea for what sort of the market zeitgeist is. So you can also use SeatGeek's detailed map to see what the view looks like from your seat. That's excellent as well. And finally, they don't have any hidden fees. Certain other sites, whom we shall not name, will attach a bunch of fees at checkout. You don't know what they are. You're excited about your tickets. You went to checkout, and now it's $20 more than you thought it was because of some fees. SeatGeek will give that to you up front. And last but not least, make sure you enter that CapSpace code on your first purchase, because that will get you a $20 rebate the first time around. Go into the settings tab, click add a promo code, enter that promo code CapSpace. We talk about it all the time on the program. That also lets them know that you came from us, which is important, so they will continue advertising and can track it. And then SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So download that free SeatGeek app, enter that promo code CapSpace today. So one thing that we talked about that was really a concern for me, probably the biggest one for Golden State, was that bench unit with Frye at center that had just been killing everyone was going to do the same to the Warriors, because they normally start with the traditional center, often Maurice Spates, to start the second quarter. And as Dan Feldman tweeted out, the Warriors were negative 33 in the second quarter before making their first sub in the playoffs, and the Cavs were plus 34. Steve Kerr, as you noted in the press conference, so yeah, what was it exactly that they did that really took Cleveland out of what they wanted to do with that second unit that had been killing it all playoffs?
Well, a big part of what the Frye at center group does is that it takes a traditional center out of their comfort zone. It's incidentally something similar to what Maurice Spates does, because he's out there, but Frye is a way better shooter and is comfortable in that catch-and-shoot role, whereas Spates is a little bit different than that. And Draymond Green neutralizes a lot of that. He is both agile enough to, you know, if you want to have him out there on Frye, he can do that. But he's also a really strong help defender, so you can kind of go at the Frye-LeBron combination in a couple different ways if you have him on the floor, and especially to a degree if you have him on the floor at center.
Yeah, they got worked in both of those stretches. And I thought that adjustment in particular was the biggest thing that led to the Warriors bench outscoring the Cavs bench by 35 points. That, per ESPN, was the largest bench scoring differential in the finals in the last 50 years.
That seems pretty good.
Lou did try to make somewhat of an adjustment, because the Warriors, as you noted, were switching everything when Frye was in the game at center. And he thought, all right, I'll bring back Kevin Love. And then when they switch everything, we can just post up. But Kevin Love just isn't really that good at posting up, and that probably even made them a little bit worse defensively. So it was, I think the other thing that was a concern for Cleveland as well, I mean, the Warriors' bench unit even was outscoring a bunch of their starters when they were in to start the fourth quarter when Golden State went on the decisive run. And even though the last 2:24 was garbage time, LeBron had 41 minutes, Love, Irving, J.R. Smith, all those guys over 36 minutes, and they didn't really play their bench guys hardly at all. Frye only played 5 minutes, and Shumpert 17 minutes, and then Richard Jefferson, for some reason, played way more than Shumpert, which made zero sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah, and I went a little bit crazy when Amon Shumpert was on the floor and both Curry and Thompson were off it. Shumpert was great on Klay Thompson last year, and while his offensive game has certainly waned from last year, his defensive intensity was actually a notable difference. He made one of the more kind of surprising plays in this game when he basically just took it upon himself to pressure Curry full court and nearly forced a turnover. It was inches away from being a Cavalier ball instead of bouncing out of bounds and being off of on Shumpert. And playing him when those players are off the floor is just a waste, because while he is a good defender in those other circumstances, he is one of my favorite examples of a guy who's a counterweight, of somebody who his biggest positive is taking away another team or another player's positive. So using him when those people aren't on the floor, it's just not worth it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. I think he probably needs to get a little more time. Either he or maybe Dellavedova. I thought that Shumpert was great on Steph when he was actually in there.
Yeah.
And the one bright spot is the way that they did defend Steph. The Warriors did not run hardly any high pick and roll for Steph. They were just sort of trying to run their stuff with Curry off the ball. And a lot of that worked. You know, I mean, we got to remember that all these other guys got off a lot because Steph was out there. Although Steph actually was the only Warrior other than Bogut who was in the negative. Steph was -1. Bogut was -8. Despite being 5 for 7. But, you know, the Cavs still, like Kevin Love, they hit him on Bogut, and Love gave up 3 buckets to Bogut just like ducking in or going backdoor. You know, that was really bad. I think other than just kind of bumping Steph around a lot and Steph just like not being forceful enough with his cuts, that they got all the details wrong defensively. Like, for example, Livingston, they just went over the screen on a pick and roll on Sean Livingston. One time they had to switch, another time they didn't switch, and that was like 2 of his easy mid-range buckets that he had in that huge run to start the fourth. Like, there's no reason you should ever not go under the screen on Livingston, but Kyrie was on him and just did that. You know, they also had times where they just had a smaller guy on Livingston, and he was able to post up. Like, you should put your smaller guy on Iguodala instead of Livingston so that you can't post up. You know, we saw that Livingston struggles against guys who actually are his size, like in the Oklahoma City series. They just got back cut a lot. They couldn't match up in transition, especially on plays where the Warriors had switched a lot, and then they had to go back and find their men. So it really, did I miss anything? What else did I miss about like Cleveland's like defensive screw-ups in this game?
I think that was about it. There were certain possessions in transition, there weren't that many, where they got lost, and sometimes that didn't produce anything. I mean, there was the one at the very end which functionally sealed the game, when both Stephen Curry and Klay Thompson were open from 3 on the same transition opportunity, and that is not okay.
Yeah, that was true too. I thought even in the third, when the Cavs made their slight run, and, you know, the Warriors were in control most of the game for sure, and just looked like they were outplaying them the whole game. The Cavs D wasn't like some amazing juggernaut. You know, they gave up layups on the first 4 possessions of the half, but the Warriors only converted, I think, on one of those plays because Steph missed a layup and then just didn't take one and threw it for some reason to Clay in the corner who was covered. I mean, you could just see Steph was like having a weird game, was discombobulated. And by the way, everyone wants to be like, oh yeah, Steph, is he injured again now? Like, everyone was making excuses for him before. Well, first of all, he showed that he was able to take bigs off the dribble in Game 7, which he wasn't earlier in the Oklahoma City series. And the few times that he did actually go one-on-one in this game, he looked fine. So it was just, he had a bad game. You think he was kind of getting jostled around and didn't respond to it very well. So there's, when you look at how he was playing and what the difference was and what he was able to physically do and what he couldn't, yeah, I'm sorry, there's a difference there. So no, he was not injured because he had a bad game. That's like very reductive and annoying when people just reduce people who's saying he might be hurt at that point.
One other thing I wanted to mention, you talked about how the Cleveland guys played a lot, and we noted it ourselves during the fourth quarter that the Warriors were not doing that. You know, while the teams pulled their starters at about the same time in this game, you know, with about 2:30 left, the Warriors, so Draymond played 40 minutes, Curry played 35, and Iguodala played 35. Klay Thompson only played 24 minutes because he missed more than half of the first half due to foul trouble.
Yeah, that's right. He was just a foul in waiting to get his third foul, and he finally did. Although he avoided getting back into it in the second half. I mean, with the Warriors being up and outplaying them, I was fine with Kerr just sitting him with the 3 fouls, especially because he has that propensity. He's not someone who's good at playing in foul trouble like certain other guys are.
And he's bad in the way, like, there are 2 different ways to be bad when you're in foul trouble. One is to be just a sieve, Blake Griffin is somebody we've talked about that before, and
Amari Stoudemire.
Amari Stoudemire, Blanco.
That in his Phoenix day.
Yeah, and then the other way to do it is to just not be aware of it, and that's something that I've harped on for Clay. I've covered the Warriors for 7 years. I've harped on that for like five. He's a smart player. He knows basketball well, but I think it's just that his instincts take over, and he's just like, this is the right defensive play. I'm gonna make it. He ended up never getting called for his fourth foul, I believe, but he nearly got called for it like four times, where he just like went in and either went for a block, went for a strip, and they all ended up being nice plays. But when you are as important as he usually is for their offense, you have to take your foot off the gas a little bit, but it didn't burn them in the slightest in this game in the second half. A
couple of little things. I thought that Dellavedova actually played pretty well offensively. He was actually really the only guy that was particularly able to find assists. You know, he had some nice alley-oops to Tristan Thompson when the Warriors weren't even necessarily over-helping. He just threw some really nice passes. And then Varejao had two flops to get offensive foul calls. One of them, when Love really, like, you know, Varejao certainly flopped to show the contact, but that was an offensive foul on Love, right? Like, he was just using his forearm to prevent Varejao from getting back in and blocking a shot. You know, it wasn't necessary. Like, you probably should be able to drive past Anderson Varejao without warding him off with your forearm. So, like, Love was gaining an advantage from the contact. So I don't mind that as much when you flop to show that someone is doing something to you that is a foul that's gaining an advantage. But then the other one, when I think he, like, went off a screen by Shumpert.
And acted like he had been shot.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, that was...
And by fantastic, that was, I mean terrible. But what's...
But I mean, I suppose there is some justice in Cleveland for whom he probably got, you know, roughly 1,000 flop calls in his career being hoisted by their own petard at least a couple of times there.
We should also mention that Barbosa had a very good game. He was super comfortable offensively. And comfortable is an important word for that because he felt like he could take Dellavedova. Not all of his points were on Dellavedova, but he felt like he could take him. And we've talked about this numerous times with Clay, that comfort is very important. Barbosa's kind of the same in terms of that. If he feels like he can get somewhere, he'll be a lot more assertive.
Yeah, Barbosa was 5 out of 5. He hit 3 tough twos outside the restricted area and a 3 that wasn't like particularly wide open, as I recall, either. Oh, actually, maybe it was.
It was pretty wide open from what I remember.
Yeah, that one was wide open. But yeah, he's obviously not going to play that way again. Livingston is not going to play that way again. But I think he could shoot 6 out of 10 instead of 8 out of 10 on those same looks. He was getting some pretty easy looks. So the Cavs are really going to have to tighten that up. Their defense on Harrison Barnes was also pretty miserable in isolation. I thought Bogut, though, did not play well. Again, he just did not get over on defense, was inadequate on the defensive glass. He had some nice cuts offensively and a couple of nice passes, but certainly I think the earlier that they take him out and go to Green at center, the better off they probably are. So,
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
So people have talked a lot about the bench scoring, and of course there's a reason for that. The historic disparity matters. Something that is not being discussed as much is that the Warriors bench, their non-starters, had 10 assists and only 1 turnover. And that is also important because that shows what you're generating and also that you're not making mistakes.
Yeah, that was outstanding. And the Warriors, despite having some really ugly turnovers, only totaled 9 in the aggregate. And Cleveland, not a team, especially when you're not playing Shumpert, that provides a ton of pressure offensively on your offense to make you turn it over. I did think that LeBron overall had a pretty decent defensive game. He was solid switching out on Curry. You could tell that he was making the effort to set the tone. Curry did turn it over, I think, one time when he tried to take LeBron, but that again was not in the middle of the floor. That's part of the problem, too, with the whole running Curry off the ball all the time thing, is that when he does catch the ball and they're off of a switch or something, he's catching it either in the corner, like the spacing in the corner was really bad a bunch of times. Like they just sort of get, you know, with throw it to someone who's in the dead corner from like 3 feet away already. Like, you know, those are just kind of dumb passes that had no chance of succeeding. But, you know, if you're in the corner or you're on the wing, there just isn't the space to take somebody off the dribble the way there is up at the top. And that's why, again, he, I think, is more effective in high pick and roll. I like the fact that, you know, they're getting everyone a touch. You can't just run high pick and roll with Curry all the time unless it's, you know, the fourth quarter of game 7 against the Thunder. But, and I mean, I think, though, that and then the fact that they're just willing to switch Love onto Clay, who drove by him for a couple of buckets, too, not to mention Love onto Steph. We didn't even see Steph try and take Love when they switched him.
Love actually, I wouldn't say forced a turnover, but was there when a turnover was committed when Steph tried to take him.
No, I would say forced it. He, like, got up on him, got a little reach in, made him uncomfortable as he tried to go behind the back in the first half. So, all right, this is what I wanted to get to, though. What can Cleveland do differently here, other than simply, all right, just do a better job on their ISOs, which I think, in terms of just individually scoring, making more shots at the rim?
Play Amon Shumpert more and make sure that his minutes tie more directly with the starters, because that's what he's good at. And Channing Frye should just play more.
Should he, though? Because there's a couple of reasons I would say they shouldn't. Number one, when you play him at center, you are basically now, Kerr is just going to go to Green at center. And I don't know if I like their matchups as much there versus if you're playing a traditional center and they have Bogut on the floor or Spates or Azealia, all of whom didn't really play very well tonight. Spates obviously didn't play till garbage time, but or Varejao. I mean, like, if you're, I think it's almost, even if you're going to say that Thompson is an inferior player, and I thought he, I mean, Frye, the Warriors switching is going to take away what they're doing anyway, I think. So with Frye, he's not going to get open looks. And JR only got three shots, too, because of all the switching. Like, that was something that they're just not getting those three-pointers from the role players. So I don't know if more Frye is the answer. I mean, maybe you can just try to get him in and see if Kerr will take the bait and keep his center in. But I don't think that he will. I think they're going to be too smart for that, as they showed with that adjustment to start the second quarter. So maybe you're just almost lulled Kerr into a false sense of security and not playing his best lineup that's just going to kill them all the time.
It's an interesting point. I mean, it does seem like eventually Kerr will figure that out. You know, it's not like there's a reason he should just play the Draymond and center lineups.
Well, I don't think it's even a question of figuring it out. He doesn't want to do that the whole game, but the Warriors just don't have another matchup for when they go with Frye or Love at center,
yeah,
other than
that's a good point.
Just going with Draymond at center. Like, they don't have a choice. Like, you're forcing Kerr to do it, which you're not if you're leaving Thompson in. We said more motion off the ball in the ISOs. I'm not sure that that's something that the Tiger can change its stripes at this point in the season, you know, to do. I mean, some of the stuff that the Warriors do is switching, where they'll have a guy cut immediately when the switch occurs. Like, that's not what Cleveland does. They just try to ISO the guy. And, you know, I still think that you're, although you can at least, like, keep the Warriors out of fast breaks a little bit when you're doing that, I don't think they're going to be successful. What else you got for Cleveland?
One thing
here
that I expected to be more successful than it was, I mean, I had talked on various outlets about the idea of Love being on Harrison Barnes, and I thought, oh, Harrison's not going to exploit that. He did a much better job, at least in the first quarter. I think he had 7 points in the first quarter. He did slow down after that. But I think you still have to go to that kind of a thing just to try to get him a little bit out of it. And, yeah, maybe Harrison will take him at some point. That's also when you want just anybody to be there as a help defender, because Harrison isn't as good going over help. But so I'd say something maybe in that vein, but that's not a fix. That's just something that might help a little bit.
Yeah, I think also when they do have a center in, as much pick and roll as possible involving that center, especially with Kyrie, because they can just kind of go under on LeBron. He can't really play in pick and roll that much anymore. Or even just some pin downs for JR, try to get him going. JR had only 33 touches in this game and passed on 28 of them. So he was just not getting the ball in position to shoot in the slightest. Just, you know, two uncontested looks, one contested, just could not even get the ball in shooting position all. And same thing with Frye. He only had one field goal attempt during the competitive portion of the game. So it's I'm not really sure what the answer is. Richard Jefferson probably should not play at all. We'll just give all his minutes to Shumpert. That's something that you can do. I don't understand what Richard Jefferson brings other than just that he's kind of a vet and won't screw up theoretically in transition, but they screwed up when he was out there anyway.
Can I give one stat?
Yeah.
It's not really an advocacy thing. So Cleveland only had three what are called screen assists in this game, which is reflective of the fact that they just didn't really have that as a key facet of their offense.
Yeah, because of the switching.
Exactly.
That's the biggest reason. And they only really have one guy who's going to score in pick and roll, and that's Kyrie. And then they have one guy who's going to come off a screen for a shot, and that's JR, and then they're just switching all that most of the time.
So the Warriors had six, which is more, but still not that many. And the Cavs were, of course, switching a fair amount too, which mitigated that. But three of the Warriors' six were made by Anderson Varejao, who played 3 minutes in the game. That's like a Biyombo level of screen assist frequency.
Yeah, maybe that means that Varejao is better than we thought he was.
Nope. His defense was still bad, other than his flop defense, which was fantastic.
All right, that's probably enough on this one. I think we've exhausted it. We'll see what ends up happening on Sunday. Let's talk some Milwaukee Bucks, or as Dan Feldman would say, Bucks here.
Yeah, and the Bucks definitely have a really interesting summer for me because they have a lot of things that are settled might be a strong word, but they have a lot of things that they know, and many of them that they didn't know at the beginning of this season, but they also have the flexibility to build off of that and actually get better.
All right, so when you say they have a lot of things that they know, what are those?
That they can actually run their offense through Giannis. That Jabari Parker is on his way to becoming a starter quality player. Maybe he's not all the way there yet, but he will be. And Chris Middleton.
Yeah, they also know that he's probably going to suck on defense for the foreseeable future.
Well, yeah.
And on the boards, for that matter. They know that they have to get better on the glass, I think, is another. And they know that they need to get more shooting. I think those are. And they also, I think, are getting closer to the idea that Michael Carter Williams may not be the long-term answer at point guard.
Maybe. God, I hate that trade. Like, that trade will bother me for the rest of my life. The fact that they could have had the Lakers pick and just instead got a guy who was just a terrible fit for their personnel. Not a bad player in the right system, but just terrible fit for them.
All right, so that's a good way to transition kind of into what these guys could use if you're really going to start to take the next step. I mean, you've got, I think, a very nice core with Middleton, Giannis, and Jabari. I don't know that I necessarily see anyone else who's around right now as, like, part of the, like, what could eventually be a contender. I think that the Greg Monroe experiment, while some of his advanced stats aren't as bad as maybe you think, and they were really bad bench-wise when he was off the floor, I still think that you're not going to have a good enough defense. He's not even really a great defensive rebounder either, and they need that a lot. They need a traditional two-way center who can play some pick and roll and also just defensive rebound and play pick and roll defense and protect the rim. I don't think that Marona is that. Fortunately, he only has a year left on that 2+1 deal that he signed at last year's max. So that's not the end of the world. And so I think they really need now, a point guard and a center of the future. And that point guard needs to be able to shoot because you have two guys, really three, Middleton, Giannis and Jabari, who all can create with the ball in their hands. So they don't need another guy who's just going to run pick and roll necessarily. And in fact, that's probably going to run into spacing issues because other than Middleton, maybe Jabari will shoot threes eventually, but he's not there yet. And Giannis, same thing. So I think you need a point guard who can shoot a lot, doesn't necessarily need the ball in his hands, and also is a pretty good defensive player. Wouldn't mind a guy who also has some length. And then I think they need some more scoring off the bench. Like all those like Bayless, Mayo, those guys are all free agents. So they're going to need some of that as well.
Yeah. And they're also going to need shot creation on that second unit because they just don't have, I think you need at least two guys who can create shots for themselves or others on this team. One of which will start probably at the one and the other one will probably be the backup at the one. And while you're right that a two-way center would be great for them, I also think that the one way being defense and defensive rebounding, just like an overall defender, is so important with the team that they've built that if they had to make that sacrifice, which they might, that it is worth it to go for, a Biyombo or Festus Ezeli type guy who is probably going to be limited offensively just to get that, because I wouldn't make the offensive side of that trade if you have to actually make that choice. But
and people really worried about this team's offense last year, but they're like kind of mid-pack. And just the defense and the defensive rebounding is what totally fell off a cliff. So maybe you can make the argument that, a defensive center would be nice. Now, what do you do with Monroe in that case if you do get him? And the other thing I wanted to ask you about, too, is do you think they'd be better straight up having Giannis handle the ball all the time and just signing another wing instead who can shoot? Or do they really need another point guard? I mean, they obviously would need and then you could play Carter Williams as kind of the backup point guard sometimes when Giannis was out, play them together a little bit, but then you'd have another guy who can shoot the ball, and now you can really switch everything 1 through 4 pretty well. I mean, Carter Williams can kind of do that, but he's pretty skinny. If you had like more of a pure wing who could also shoot, now maybe your defense would be able to prevent penetration a lot better than they had already.
I think it's worth considering, but
And there's more wings in this free agent market than point guards, which is kind of why I think that way.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're, you know, like, so you're basically you're thinking about maybe somebody like Bazemore, like kind of to be the...
Bazemore, I'm thinking maybe even like Eric Gordon, Courtney Lee. I think Eric Gordon would be good because he's big enough to switch on to larger guys.
Do you think he can guard ones, though? Like, if even in kind of, or would you just have, because I don't trust...
No, that you're just gonna switch.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not, he wouldn't be great guarding ones, but I think you're just going to switch.
Just
and then, you know, if it got into
Giannis a start on the ones, to be like, yeah, let's do that.
The problem is that none of those guys are really that, even Middleton, they're not really that great at getting over picks.
Yeah.
And I guess you would, if you're Eric Gordon is your defender on the other team's point guard and you're running a 1-5 pick and roll and you can't switch, yeah, it probably could get a little bit ugly. But again, you know, I think they are not necessarily at the point where they're looking for, like, the next guy to add to their core.
The guy who's going to put them over the top for a championship or anything like that. I think that's definitely a fair way to think about it. And, yeah, bench, just for the second unit, I would say talent all over the floor. I mean, some of that could be retaining, depending on if they bring back Vasquez or Miles Plumlee, both of whom at the right price I think would be worth it. But the Bucks, as much as they've hit kind of at the top of the draft, this is where missing on, well, we hope he gets better, but like Rashad Vaughn, you know, if that player was a 10 to 15 minute a game guy next year, reliable, doing something well, that would be a really nice perk for them and have somebody on a rookie scale contract. And so they do have the number 10 pick in this draft. That could be another way to do it. And while it's a little bit unreasonable to think that, especially in a weak draft, that a second round pick could do that, they do have two of them, so maybe if one of them can become a guy who can just be, you know, maybe your fifth person in that kind of a positional rotation, so like the fifth guard, that could be enough to help.
Yeah, they will have a little bit of a roster crunch coming up, depending on how many of these guys they re-sign. They are slated to have, under what I'm characterizing as the most likely scenario, $21 million in cap space. That includes that cap hold for the number 10 pick, which is a little over $2 million, and then also Miles Plumlee, his cap hold at $5.2 million as a restricted free agent. His qualifying offer is in the fours. Do you think that it's worth re-signing Plumlee? I thought he had some okay moments for them. He is like 27 already. Or do you think they're just better dumping his cap hold? You could do better on the market with, you know, that $5.2 million.
I'm going to give the lawyer answer, but it depends. I mean, I think that if you can get him at a backup center price for, let's say, 2 or 3 years, yeah, that's fine. But any more than that, and I wouldn't want to do it. And that's kind of the issue with having match rights on him, is just that, you know, you're hoping that somebody else just, that he accepts something small. And so at that point, maybe he'll just accept that with you, because if he's going to take, you know, let's say 2 years, $5 million per year, it's like 210, you can just offer that to him. So maybe you decline that. I don't think it would give that much ill will in that sense. But at the same point, you know, like, I'm not sure exactly what they're going to do with their money. So if they, you know, if they get a feeling of that, and also if they really need to clear money, depending on what they're getting, but I assume one of the things for that could be a big man, just because the point guard crop is so bad, that then you start to think about potentially trading Greg Monroe. And Greg Monroe, while they could keep him, and I actually really like him as a second unit guy, he can help. He's such a good passer that he can kind of be the key cog in the wheel for the offense. But you can thread this needle of trading a recently signed free agent if you can find a team that is willing to actually give him a role that he'd be happier with than staying with you.
Yeah, that's possible. So what do you think they could get from him? He only has 1 year left on his contract. Not a ton of teams come to mind as like, oh, hey, we could really use an offensive center. And we've remarked many times on how all offense post-up centers who don't play a ton of defense don't really fit that well in today's NBA as starters. And so you mentioned as a backup, I think they're good to provide some second unit scoring. But yeah, I'm not really sure who they would need. I mean, I do like re-signing Plumlee. I think that he does a lot of things reasonably well. You know, he's not terrible on defense. He protects the rim okay, not great. He can get up for some alley-oops every once in a while in the pick and roll, get on the offensive glass, good rebounder, plays hard, runs the floor in transition because he's a Plumlee. And his qualifying offer actually is $3 million. So probably no risk that he would just take that. And if he does, you'd be happy if he did to have him for 1 year, $3 million. And then, you know, obviously after that, he becomes unrestricted after that year. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know that trading Monroe is necessarily possible. One guy who they have been talked about potentially getting in a Calvin Watkins article about like where Dwight might go. What do you think of his fit in Milwaukee for, you know, like a 3-year, $20 million a year deal that they would have space for?
He would definitely help set the defensive tone and the defensive culture. I mean, he isn't the day-in, day-out beast that he was in his earlier days, but he can definitely be a positive player on that end. And I don't love the fit offensively for a couple of different reasons, just because he's not the best passer when you give him attention, and he grouses when he doesn't get his touches. But
yeah, and then what happens to Monroe, too? Like, like those two guys being on the same team, they'd probably
Monroe would be pretty physical. PTSD about playing with a true center and just...
Yeah, like with Drummond in Detroit.
That is what I was alluding to, yeah. And so, but one thing with Monroe, that his price point is not bad, and I think that there is this pressure to think about, you know, how the Bucks would use their money at the beginning of free agency, and that, you know, that certainly is a consideration. But there will be teams in the third week of July, and maybe even a little bit later than that, that will just have more cap space than they know what to do with. And Monroe is a really nice fit for any team that wants to get better but doesn't want to make their long-term books worse. So this could be the Lakers, that the Lakers just want to get better. So, yeah, it's true.
Yeah, he'll solve their defensive problems.
But he'll solve their defensive problems. But, you know, like, let's say they, you know, they don't get that center. You know, he's kind of like a way better overall player, Roy Hibbert kind of a thing. And so for the Bucks,
just in the sense that he has 1 year left on his contract.
So you're not losing the flexibility for 2017. You get a guy who can actually play, and the Lakers have that issue of just not having enough dudes, especially at center. That's just an example. There will probably be, if I had to ballpark it right now, six to eight teams after a couple weeks in free agency that will just have like $20 million in space and just be like, well, crap. And, you know, maybe that'll end up being the Sixers, who have no need for Greg Monroe. So that's an opportunity. But that all, of course, ties back into the idea of what the Bucks would want for it. Because if what they want is just kind of to get out of it and to put him in a better situation, that kind of a thing, then you don't need very much. Then, you know, a second-round pick or
I mean, that's only if they sign another center. I mean, they kind of need him still.
Yeah, otherwise,
despite
they do.
That, because they don't have another starter-level, probably
so,
two-way center.
Yeah, if they got, you know, Howard or Biombo or, you know, somebody like that. And I feel like those players should listen to Milwaukee if they come calling. They have a fun young team. It's a talented, you know, I think they have a lot of guys who are young, and they have a lot of guys who are still going to be cheap for a while, which is very good for them. But that actually ties in with something I wanted to talk with you about, which is Giannis is going to be eligible for an extension.
Yeah, maybe we could table that for a second and to talk about 2017. But I mean, I guess we'll keep that just in the back of our minds that they could have $50 million in 2017 space, which, you know, would be eaten up by that. His cap hold is, I think, only $7 million. So it's going to be so much lower than what his eventual salary would be that it seems like it wouldn't make a ton of sense for them to extend him now, just because you're punting on as much as, you know, $17, $18 million in cap space potentially by extending him now. Presumably he's going to get the max. I think it would be – he would certainly not sign anything other than the max. He never gets hurt or anything either. He's super young still. The other thing that's an issue for them this year, though, because I think, all right, it would make a lot of sense, like, all right, this free agent class sucks. These guys aren't ready to win yet. Just keep the powder dry, 2017, get into the market with all these awesome young players. But it would really help if they made the playoffs next year to help these guys look better than they did this year. You know, obviously, 2015, they're probably really ahead of schedule. But if they don't want to just punt on that space for nothing this year, that $22 million or so, up to $27 million, depending on what happens with Plumlee, because if they don't make the playoffs, then it's like, well, why are you going here instead of the other 8 million places you can go that also have cap space in 2017? So it's going to take, I think, a very fine line that they're going to have to walk of like maintaining future flexibility and also trying to get better this year. And part of the problem with that is that they don't really have any kind of a bench. You know, they've got John Henson, And that's basically it. And, you know, Carter Williams, who you might look at as a backup if they can get another point guard in, but they don't really have anyone else under contract that they trust. It's Tyler Ennis, who hasn't done anything in his career. Rashad Vaughn, who I think, you know, is young, and I'm not really to write him off yet, but counting on him to contribute next year. Damian Inglis, Johnny O'Brien. Like, none of those guys have developed into the type of player that you could trust at all in the rotation. And so now, I mean, they would probably, even if they want to just fill out their bench, you might be hard-pressed to do that with $21 million in space remaining.
Yeah, you're right. That could be a challenge in terms of that, and that's why I would try to go, if you can get it, of course, it's an issue of having the right person say yes, to for more of a single player and just try to do some value plays on the other end of it. And they also just, there is this challenge, I guess, with the Bucks that you talk about the idea of how they could have all this cap space that, and I mean no offense to the people of Milwaukee and the great state of Wisconsin, their cap space is not as valuable as certain other teams. And yes, they did just get Greg Monroe, and that is wonderful, but you're not just sitting there like you're the Lakers or the Knicks or something like that and going, oh, well, we can't jeopardize this space. You know, if the right person came along, that is completely separate from the Giannis thing. I agree with you on the substance that they should not extend Giannis. I also think that they should not come to an extension with Michael Carter-Williams because there's no idea what his value is. He actually has a similar hold to Giannis because they were drafted at almost... They were drafted.
Yeah, his is actually higher.
Yeah, because he was drafted a little bit higher than him. I think it was... Was it 8 and... you would know.
It was 11 and 15.
That's, okay. And so... So, like, you run into kind of situations with those guys for opposite reasons. But if the right person comes along, I would have no qualms, whether it's trading for a player or signing somebody outright, cutting into that space for the right person. You just don't want to be stupid about it.
I think that's right. And I think the ideal scenario for them maybe would be, all right, we're going to get Howard or we're going to get another defensive center, and then we're going to trade Monroe for, you know, a decent backup point guard who can shoot a little bit and maybe another wing guy who at least we trust a little bit in the rotation. Failing that, which I think is pretty attenuated, so we shouldn't get into it that much. Guys that I looked at as potentially that they could sign on the wing, you can shoot Courtney Lee and Eric Gordon, we mentioned. I think J.R. Smith actually would be a solid fit for them with his skill set. You know, I'm thinking more of kind of pure twos because they have plenty of combo forward types already defensively. I think Etuan Moore could be solid for them as well as a guy who could defend point guards pretty well, shoots it reasonably well from three, but doesn't really need the ball in his hands. Alan Crabb, another guy I think could actually fit pretty well with them, also more on the timeline with these guys. He can shoot the ball, but again, doesn't need to have the ball in his hands, probably shouldn't have the ball in his hands. And then on the lower end of the market, Troy Daniels could be another guy, a restricted free agent with the Hornets. And the Hornets are going to have a lot of other stuff going on with guys that are going to try to re-sign and stuff, so that he might be pluckable as well. And then also maybe a shooting big backup center, power forward type they could use as well. There's some guys out there of that ilk.
Yeah, I like Teletovic there. I think he could do a nice job of just being a...
We like Teletovic everywhere. I always worry on these that we're just like repeating all the same guys that we like in free agency for all of these teams.
Yeah, we do. Hey, we're not mentioning all of the like defensive threes in this one, so that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But I want to...
Yeah, well, where is like Al Jefferson going to end up? You know, that's like what teams need Al
Whatever
Jefferson?
Team
we haven't found like
trade
one
for
team
Greg
that
Monroe,
needs him yet.
But the guy who I want to mention as a fascinating possibility for this, and I wrote about this in the SN piece when it comes out, is Matthew Dellavedova. Dellavedova,
yeah, I like him
fits
there too.
In really well with their starting lineup because he is a nice, I think he's better as a secondary ball handler than a primary. He has a lot of experience dealing with a ball dominant forward, and I mean that, of course, in a good way. And he can hit open shots. And he
40% on
and
threes.
He defends.
Pretty close to that for his career, I think.
So
yeah.
He checks all of their boxes. And the other reason why I love that fit is because, worst case scenario, if you make him an offer that you would be okay with, but that is aggressive, you know, like, so the kind of thing that would be his best offer sheet unless somebody does something really dumb, is if Cleveland matches it, then all you did is you made a rival's luxury tax bill way higher. And there's nothing wrong with that. You did your best shot.
What would you offer him if you were the Bucks?
$444 million. And I think Cleveland.
Yeah, that's a little.
It's a little steep, but.
But yeah, I mean, if you want to get him, you probably maybe you do.
Yeah,
I don't know.
He's 25,
we'll see.
So I mean, you'll get him for those years, and.
All right, so you're good with him as your starting point guard for that. I mean, I guess, and then Carter Williams is probably going to be gone after a year,
right,
if you're already paying him $11 million.
You would still have enough money on top of that, that if it didn't work, that you could just try to get another point guard. But this market also just is bad for it. And from what I know about the draft, it isn't really like that. They could get a developmental guy there in that way, but there isn't really a perfect fix. And I actually think there's a chance that Cleveland would match it at that price.
4 years. The years is what I think would kill me on that. You know, 2 for 22 or something. I mean, and a restricted free agent, you have to offer at least 2 years. So 2 for 22 might be like a little bit more, something along the lines that I might think. I mean, just locking him to him with that kind of money as your starting point guard for that long, like, it really kind of, you know, I'd like somebody who's a little bit more dynamic scorer, could like play off the ball a little. I mean, just how he's going to look in a system without LeBron James around him, or it's really, I question that a little bit. I mean, I'm thinking more, you know, $8 or $9 million a year.
I just don't think you're going to get him for that. Honestly.
Yeah, no, maybe not. But I think like where they are at, I don't know that I want to overpay like that badly for someone that is just ultimately not going to move the needle for your franchise. I think another guy, and I'm sure they'll make the call on Mike Conley, and he'll probably say no. Conley would obviously be unbelievable for them. Deron Williams, I think, could be an excellent fit as a guy. Number one, probably shouldn't play more than 20 or 25 minutes a game with his health history. So he could, you know, you have, at the very least, Carter Williams is a good backup. I think even you, who have never been his biggest fan, would probably agree on that.
Yeah, I think, especially if a lot of teams play smaller ones, he can do well there.
Yeah, and so D-Will can shoot it. He's not going to just kill you in pick and roll, but and he's also a guy who can switch reasonably well. I think Brandon Jennings could also be a decent buy low candidate who, you know, sometimes he could close games, sometimes he could be Carter Williams. DJ Augustin, a guy who can shoot a little bit, not really a starter-level guy, but fits well playing off the ball. Mario Chalmers could be a reclamation project, another guy who doesn't have to have the ball in his hands, can still shoot, but obviously the torn Achilles bothers you there. And then on the restricted market, Seth Curry and Isaiah Cannon would also, I think, be reasonable targets. Again, guys who can shoot off the ball, and Cannon, hopefully the rest of your perimeter defense will protect him in his ability to just simply stand next to the other point guard, which I guess people thought was funny yesterday. But
I like how a lot of the guys that we thought of as fits for the Bucks have played on the Bucks previously.
I think everybody has played on
the
Bucks.
That's true.
Previously.
Like, did John Lure ever play for the Bucks?
I feel like he did, actually.
I think
that might have been like his first organization, just because he came out of Wisconsin and just they're familiar with him or whatever. Other shooting bigs that I think could work for them. I mean, I would love if they just played like Jason Smith at center sometimes. Again, your rebounding is probably not going to be much better there, but, you know, just for a different look, get some shooting around Jabari and Giannis. Mo Spates might be a solid fit as a backup center. I mean, they still got Henson and they've got Monroe, so this would probably assume that, and Plumlee too. So some of those guys would probably go if you're going to get them.
Do you think Henson could be their starter at center? Do you think, because he is quite good at, like, if I said you want a defense only guy, he's not terrible if you give him that role.
No, I mean, he is one of the game's best rim protectors, but he's never actually, his advanced stats have never been that good. The on-off stuff for him defensively, he's not as quick kind of switching out on guys as you might hope for a guy with his length and his build and as sort of like a small forward, power forward-ish type of guy in college. And he's not a good on the defensive glass either. So, I mean, I thought his contract extension at the time was a fair one as a guy who's sort of, you know, maybe can start for you in a pinch, but you probably wouldn't want starting, you know, as an $11 million a year guy. I think it just, it's a lot of it depends on the matchup with him.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
All right. I guess the other thing to mention too for 2017 is, let's say they take the approach of, all right, we're going to not extend Giannis and we're going to just use his small cap hold, use all of our cap space. Well, the cap is 107 and the tax is going to be 127. So now you're at the cap and you're going to give Giannis a new contract that's $17 million more than what his cap hold was. And now you're basically almost at the tax already if you do that. So that's going to be something to consider as well, both in the contracts that they sign this year that could go into next year. And then you also would have to pay Jabari at some point too.
1 year later.
Middleton at least is on a good contract. So this is a team that could be cutting into the tax if you're going to get to where you're pretty close to maxing out Jabari and Giannis. I mean, Giannis's max is going to be $25 million probably with the 107 cap. So that's something to keep in mind. They're going into the new arena, but especially if this team isn't a contender, the Bucks don't seem like the type of team that's going to like really get deep into the tax, which could be a possibility, even though the small cap hole does give them a chance to use more cap room at least that year.
One crazy evil idea I thought of, which is sadly not relevant anymore, is that if they had kept that Clippers pick, that they should have made a run at Austin Rivers just to raise his price to screw with the Clippers whose pick they own. But no.
Yes. All right. Now we're getting too far in the weeds. You got anything to plug? You have your content on The Athletic, obviously, about the game.
Yeah, I'll have two pieces people. For The Athletic. And also, since this is going to be our last recording before the weekend, I will put out another Real Jam Radio, which is the Portland Trailblazers offseason preview with Eric Gunderson, which was fun. We actually already recorded it.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll look forward to that. And hopefully you'll have some new stuff to say versus our offseason preview. But yeah, we're hoping to get into Brandon Ingram as well. We did Ben Simmons yesterday, a scouting report on him. And we'll be back on Sunday night then after game two. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. I'm obviously live tweeting all the games. Danny is Danny LaRue. And of course, thank you to everyone who patronizes our sponsors, SeatGeek today with the Capspace code, and also everyone who has given us ratings or reviews on iTunes. That I think has been really helpful, getting us up there in the rankings, helping other people to find the show. And I even use some of those in talking to sponsors. So that's another way that it really helps the show. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back Sunday night.